which is in QST Magazine, February issue, I think it's 1976. And I think I told you guys that when I, back in 1990, I'm working for about a solid year as a principal investigator for an antenna system on an F-15 airplane at Rome Air Development Center in Utica, New York. Let me drop it. Their outdoor antenna range, which is a mile and a half long between two mountains, with fiber optic cables between the two and computer control and whatever, arguably one of the world's best outdoor antenna ranges. It uses the ratiometry antenna range technique. I remember asking those engineers, who set that up as a ratiometry antenna range? That's a very unusual thing. And they told me, yeah, this old antenna engineer that we had here used to do that. He's no longer with us. He set that up starting somewhere around 1980 or so. And that article of mine was 1976. I think there's a medium good chance that he set up that antenna range based on my article, but the people working there now didn't know it. I didn't tell them where I think it came from. Anyhow, with that ratiometry antenna range in my backyard, I could resolve 0.05 dB of gain change, a 20th of a decibel of gain change. I could resolve it day in and day out, hour to hour, with almost no ambiguity. You talk to the average antenna engineer, and he'll tell you that a real good anechoic chamber, if they can get gain to the nearest half a dB, they consider it success. And I'm 10 times better than that. 0.05 dB was the resolution of gain change that I could see. Let me drop. So with that high resolution antenna range, I'm tuning up a 19 element Yagi on 432. And as I'm discovering that, as I change the length and position of each one of those 17 or 16 parasitic elements, plus driven element, it had two reflectors, by the way, I recognized that the length of the element is extremely critical. The diameter of the element, extremely critical. The position of the element, very non-critical. I could take each of the elements on this 432 Yagi, where the elements are 12 inches long approximately. I could take any one of those elements and move it a solid inch forward or back, and I would have come back to almost the exact same gain. If I didn't do it in an accumulative manner, if I change all the spacings by an inch, yeah, all hell breaks loose. But I can take one or two, maybe even three elements at a time, and stagger them in position along the boom by an inch, which is quite a big chunk of a wavelength on 432. And essentially nothing happened. You change the length of an element by a 16th of an inch, then all hell breaks loose. Maybe an eighth of an inch, but still. You need the spacing, the length of the elements to the nearest eighth of an inch, 16th of an inch, to really get all the performance to come back, particularly if it's not accumulative. The way you chamfer the perimeter, the tips of the elements, whether they're square or slightly rounded off, makes a difference. And I was using 3/16 of an inch diameter elements, thank goodness. If I had used 1/8 of an inch diameter elements, which is popular for the Cushcraft Yagis, my goodness, does that antenna become squirrely. You just get drops of water on an 1/8 inch diameter element on 432. Let me drop. And the extra capacitance of the droplets of water, the dew in the morning, can sometimes make the antenna fire in the wrong direction. You got it aimed north, and because the dew on the elements is making all your directors act like reflectors, it'll fire to the south. You make the elements at a 3/16 diameter, and almost all of that on 432 disappears. Not only do you have a stronger looking, beautiful antenna, but a lot of the squirrely tuning characteristics with droplets of water goes away. So, as you can see, a Yagi is a weird mixture of things that are critical and not critical. I can take each one of those directors and make them non-coplanar, twist them in polarization by plus or minus 30 degrees. Nothing happens. Shift each one of them one at a time, forward or aft, by an inch. Nothing happens. Change them by an 1/8 of an inch in length, and all hell breaks loose. As you can see, a Yagi is a weird structure of critical and non-critical elements. When you really do the tuning on a high-resolution antenna range and you see this, it's quite an eye-opener. I wonder if you've heard some of this before, Barry. N2MB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I've heard you discuss it, and basically what you're saying is that if it's a small antenna, you know, like five elements or something like that, the space in between the elements is really uncritical. But what you said, I think you said, is is when you get into a multi-element beam, if you start to fool around with the spacing, it does add up. It's like putting magnifying glasses in a row. You could move them back and forth a little bit, but if they're all staggered, it's going to be very blurry.
That's a very good way of putting it, Barry. Another thing that I discovered, that a lot of guys would take the Ed Tilton 13-element Yagi and decide they wanted a little bit more gain, so they'd add some more directors. They'd make it a 15-element or a 16-element Yagi. Instead of the gain increasing, it fell off. So people in 1972 timeframe, when you and I were cutting our teeth on 432, were starting to say that long Yagis don't work. They fall out of performance if you make them longer. And if you just make all the elements the same length and the same spacing and add more elements to it, absolutely. Because when you look at it correctly, let me drop.
By the way, does this stupid thing sound better now?
Starting to sound real good. It sounds like you find the right control. The array of parasitic elements, your director string up front, is a synthesized magnifying glass. It's gathering, in the case of 432 Long Yagi, you're gathering energy from a 5.5-foot diameter of space, and you're taking all of that energy by way of that slow wave structure called director string, and you're focusing it down on the driven element. If you decide to go from a 13-element Yagi to a 19-element Yagi, for instance, you have to make all of the elements a little bit shorter so that your magnifying glass, which is really your director string, synthesized magnifying glass, has a longer focal length. You want that to now focus on the driven element further away. You just add some extra directors to your Yagi, and you're going to be focusing not on the driven element, you're going to be focusing on the third director up front, if you know what I mean, and the gain falls off. So, by that philosophy, once you understand what's really going on, let me drop. There is essentially no limit to how long you can make a Yagi and make it work well. You and I know Dave Olin, K1WHS, a real smart antenna designer up in Lebanon, Maine, who runs a company called Directive Systems, where he sells these Yagis. He has a Yagi on either 3.5 or 5 gigahertz, which has 102 elements. Back in the days when you and I were cutting our teeth on 432, a 13-element Yagi was considered very long, and the guys who were then experimenting with 15 and 16-element Yagis that didn't work, everybody started saying, long Yagis, you can't go beyond a certain length, it falls out. When I used to lock horns with Dr. Henry Jasek, the guy who wrote the Antenna Engineering Handbook, he used to be the president of Jasek Antenna Laboratories in Syosset, and AIL bought him and made him a vice president. And so he and I, as antenna tweakers working for the same company, AIL, we ran into each other one or two times per week. Let me drop it. Now, one of the areas where he and I locked horns, in a friendly manner, we had a friendly disagreement, was that my 19-element Yagi, I was complaining, I was claiming it had 15 over dipole, 17 dB over isotropic of gain. And he came to the conclusion the Yagi-like structure has a sound barrier at 16 dB over isotropic. You cannot exceed 16 dB, and here I'm claiming 17, and I'm claiming traceability to the Bureau. And he says, Ned, you may think so, but you're crazy. I said, yes, I've done it. And Dr. Henry Jasek, Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU of Bell Laboratories, was present at the antenna range where we made the measurement on multiple occasions. Who was right, Henry or Dick? And the answer is both. Because he was doing it by a technique where he was plugging the elements through the boom, and he had aluminum to aluminum contact, and the aluminum oxide was giving him a loss that he didn't know about. Therefore, with his method of construction, and his carefully tuned anechoic chamber, where he had had this contract for the maximum gain of a Yagi, he came to the conclusion you cannot exceed 16 dB over isotropic. By his method of construction, he was correct. Let me drop. And I
brief, put together all the pieces, taking multiple element Yagis that actually performed beyond his expectations.
It all got started because I had purchased from somebody 4 Yagis of the Tilton design, the 13-element Tilton Yagis. I had purchased 4 of them, and I was just starting to set up this radiometry antenna range in the backyard. I decided to measure the 4 Yagis, and I got 4 different gains. I said, what in the world is going on here? When I take my ruler and measure the element positions and the element spacing, they were all identical. How can the Yagis have different gains? I then got the idea of going down the string with an ohm meter, and I found that some of the elements plugged through the boom were making contact and some of them were not. And I suddenly realized what's going on. When the element goes through the boom, it makes good contact. When it's brand new, you get one particular length of your director. When it finally starts breaking contact on one side or both sides because of aluminum oxide, it's an entirely different antenna. You got now different electrical lengths. I got around that problem by insulating all the elements by putting them in plastic blocks sitting above the boom, held on with tie wraps. And so the original design of the 19-element insulated Yagi, all the elements were sitting on top. Along came George Flanagan, W2KRM, who said, hey, we make a slight modification of this. Let me drop it. Where each of the elements go through the boom with shoulder bushings, where now they're insulated from the boom, but they're going through the boom. Mechanically, it's a superior design, pretty looking. And now you get all the performance improvement, and you don't get gain degradation. Any of these guys who have long Yagis, where the elements go through the boom, the gain is very slowly degrading on them as aluminum oxide is built up over the years. It happens so slowly they don't know about it. If you're talking about a three-element Yagi on 40 meters, 20 meters, the effect is not very great. You talk about a 16-element Yagi on 432, this effect can easily kill 7, 8, 9 dB of gain, in my opinion. It can get that bad if you're not insulating the elements. And so that's the origin of the insulated Yagi. And so by that method of construction, I'm reasonably sure that my 17 dB of gain over isotropic, which succeeded Henry Jasek's sound barrier of 16 dB, that I was telling the truth. I don't know if I made that real clear to him, that insulating the elements was the factor. He was just positive that the Yagi-like structure could not exceed 16 dB of gain over isotropic. N2MB, who's asking a set of questions, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Can you tell me if the field is still good again? Now, in our opinion, he was probably using new aluminum, new elements, and when he was doing his work. So why was he running into the barrier when he was using components which were making good connections?
I'm glad you asked. Because your boom, in the case of a 432 Yagi, is in the vicinity of an inch, inch and a quarter diameter, and your elements are 12 inches long, your boom is grabbing onto the element near the center, an inch apart from left to right side. If you were doing impedance matching at that point, your feed impedance to that element would probably be, let me pick a number, 5 ohms. Because if you were building a folded dipole structure with such a small spacing, a T-match, so to speak, you'd probably see 5 ohms. In the case of a 5-ohm impedance, when you make half an ohm or a quarter of an ohm of resistance on the aluminum to aluminum oxide on the two sides, you're starting to get significant loss. You need micro-ohms of conductivity between the element and the boom in order not to have an effect. If it was one element at a time, you wouldn't see it. When you're doing it on 16 elements and they all start adding up, all these micro-ohms start adding up, your sensitivity is, in my opinion, is milli-ohms. You've got milli-ohms of sensitivity, and therefore it's a very subtle thing because of what's going on, because you're grabbing that element suit so close to the center where the impedance is very low. And can you guarantee that two chunks of aluminum coming together, when one of them was drilled out from the boom and it's got all kinds of, let me drop, at the microscopic level, it's got all kinds of drill marks and ridges in the aluminum, and you got this aluminum rod going through there, and you got some kind of a clamping mechanism, which maybe is a screw pushing down from the top of the boom into the element in order to capture it. You got a bunch of flaky contacts when you need milli-ohms of contact resistance on every one of those elements. At the microscopic level, it's kind of flaky, and you're going to get variations in performance. N2MB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think you really ain't, or just let it drop. Over. Okay, anyway, let me know that this sounds okay, by the way. I think I understand exactly what you're saying, and I believe, I think,
because I have several of your antennas on the roof of the house, by the way. The elements are in no way connected to the boom, I assume. They are absolutely insulated. No screws going through them or anything. They're completely insulated. Is that right?
Give that man a cigar. Absolutely. Those retaining washers on the outside of the shoulder bushings mean that there is no aluminum-to-aluminum contact between that element and the boom. That element, by way of the shoulder bushings, completely floats in the middle of that boom, and as such, there's almost no degradation that can take place. Oh, in the worst case, your push-on star washers are going to build up a little bit of aluminum oxide between it and the element, but the star washers are so small in diameter, wavelength-wise, connected to nothing. They probably can change by 0.01 picofarad when you break contact. In other words, their impedance because of the 0.1 picofarad is many thousands of ohms. And is your contact resistance going to suddenly jump to thousands of ohms between that aluminum contact and detune that element? I won't say it's perfect, but it's the level of degradation you get from that one factor is so darn small that I haven't yet found anybody that has made a measurement on a 19-element insulated Yagi that was 20 years old where he saw any significant amount gain difference. Let me drop. There are none.
Okay,
there are a number of
432.
There are a number of 432 megahertz gain competitions throughout the United States where the standard gain antenna they're using is a 19-element insulated Yagi. So over the years, they haven't seen any gain degradation of that antenna. N2MB, K2LIW.
Directive Systems is in Virginia.
K1WHS, Dave O'Lean, must have sold the business to a company in Virginia. He used to be located for lots of years in Lebanon, Maine. Isn't that the place you know about, Barry? N2MB, K2LIW. And by the way, I did hear him saying he was getting out of the business, so it sounds like he sold it to a company in Virginia. Over to you, Barry.
Okay, I'm becoming slightly less attentive because I'm answering telephone calls at the same time. So I'm just going to back out because I can't handle the telephone and the radio. I'll be back in a few minutes. N2MB.
Yeah, who is it that just told us Directive Systems is now in Virginia? Give me your call letter, sir.
This is K1MJM, mic number 2.
Mic number 2, good
information.
And by the way, mic number 2, for those who want to know what that is, you go to limartechnet.com and you'll find a whole lot of extra information relevant to the TechNet and other things about Yagi tuning antenna radicals and pictures of some of these antennas that I'm describing to you and so on. So Mike's got a nice website. And I've got a couple more technical articles I should be submitting to you. I've been promising you for some time, Mike. Other than that, my guess is you have a counter on your website, Mike, number 2, on limarktechnet.com. I'll bet you that counter has run up a pretty good number by now. K1MJM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, I think we're up to 1,000 now. I have a 45-element Yagi from Directive Systems on 1.42 gigahertz.
Yeah. In the old days, if you in 1972, during the days when Ed Tilton, the guy who invented the World Above 50 Megacycles article in QST Magazine, if you told him in 1972 that you were thinking about building a 45-element Yagi, guarantee with good background basal information, he'd be able to tell you, you're probably wasting your time, Mike. It can't possibly work. And by the techniques that we used for tuning Yagis in those days, he was right. But you take modern tuning techniques, modern insulating techniques for the elements, and as I told you, the biggest Yagi antenna I know of by Directive Systems with 102 elements, and when you measure the gain of that antenna, are all 102 elements peaking and perking and doing their thing? The answer is yes. Do you get the predictable amount of gain for that number of wavelengths of boom? The answer is yes. You go to the articles by Gunter Hock, DL6WU. He's got a whole series of articles where he takes the world's best Yagis and he's got them on a chart where number of elements or length of boom in wavelengths is the horizontal dimension and the vertical dimension is the measured gain in decibels. He's got a bunch of dots on that chart. Let me drop. He's got a bunch of dots on that chart with the Yagi design, the call letters of the Yagi designer alongside of each one of those dots. And now you start connecting all the dots with a line, a curve, and now you've got this predictable gain of a Yagi versus number of wavelengths. And he has, in turn, has taken that measured real data, converted it into a formula. And now there's a famous formula by DL6WU where you tell him not the number of elements, you tell him the number of wavelengths of boom. And assuming you've got nearly the correct distribution of parasitic elements along that boom, as long as you've got a reasonable distribution of elements with reasonable tuning on a boom of X number of wavelengths, his curve will predict for you exactly what gain you're going to get out of that Yagi. And so, very well-respected curve. Lots of real data goes into it. And so, the length of the boom, which really is the length of the focal length of the magnifying glass, so to speak. Let me drop.
But the number of elements is what? Is it approximately a quarter of a wave between elements?
It's not quite that simple, Barry. That curve will tell you that you tell him and that curve the number of wavelengths of boom on whatever frequency, and he will predict for you the gain on the assumption you have a reasonable distribution of parasitic elements. And now he has come up with a so-called DL6W broadband design. In other words, in the old days we used to think if you drastically taper the elements, make them shorter up front and longer when they're closer to the driven element, you'll get greater bandwidth. The answer is yes, but you take a gain sacrifice. He has found a particular way of tapering the elements, which in some cases is a little bit of a Coke bottle taper. They don't just simply taper always shorter as you go forward. And so if you want the absolute maximum gain, you want to get that last half a dB. Let me drop it. You want to get that last half a dB because you're really going for broke on a really state-of-the-art moonbound system. Yes, in theory, there is an exact position and exact length of each element that'll give you the absolute maximum. But if you're willing to slack it off a little bit from that with the Gunter Hock design, which gives you very forgivable bandwidth with his design, you can take the Gunter Hock design, and maybe the particular design you're starting off with is a 22-element Yagi, and you decide to build only 16 elements of it. At first you would say, gee, I'm now looking for a shorter focal length of that magnifying glass, I better retune all the elements. By normal tuning techniques, that's true. With the Gunter Hock design, it's amazingly forgiving. You build a fraction of that antenna, and you'll get the 95% of the performance that you should be getting for that length of antenna. It's a very forgiving design. And so, what is the proper spacing between the directors? It's in the vicinity of a quarter wavelength, but they're not all exactly a quarter wavelength. There's a so-called velocity profile. In other words, let me drop. Each of your directors of a parasitic element of a Yagi antenna is tuned above, is tuned shorter, tuned to a higher frequency. They're all a little bit short. Therefore, they are in impedance, they're capacitive. Therefore, the wave flowing down the boom from free space that's near that element sees the extra capacitance of the impedance of that element, and the wave gets slowed down. So all of your directors are a slow wave structure. And if you now made a three-dimensional diagram of what's going on, of that wavefront, that wavefront that came from a long distance away is a completely flat, parallel wavefront. As it starts entering the vicinity of your Yagi, the portion of the wave closer to the boom gets slowed down more than the wave that's further away from the boom. And this is happening in three-dimensional space. And if you get that slow wave structure tuned just right, pretty soon you get this beautiful curved wavefront, which really is focusing And it's because Huygens' principle tells you that an RF wave flows at right angles to the local phase front, the local phase plane, so to speak. Let me drop. So when that wave starts taking on a concave wave shape, the phase front starts taking on a concave wave front when viewed from the driven element, and all of the little portions of that wave are propagating at right angles to the local phase front. That's Huygens' principle. You can see how you're getting this magnifying glass-like focusing. And so, in order for that whole process, for a particular boom length to be maximized, the amount of slow wave structure, is the wave propagating at 90%, 95%, 85% of the speed of light in the vicinity of your boom? When you plot speed of the wave versus position along the boom, that's called the velocity profile. And when you get that curve of velocity profile versus position along the boom to fit a particular optimum curve, you get the maximum gain, you get the maximum focusing, you get the greatest forward gain, you get this beautiful wavefront that focuses all that energy from a 5.5-6 foot diameter of space down to your driven element. You get 16, 17, 18 dB of gain, if you know what I mean. And you'll discover also that your apparent aperture distribution is uniform across that circular aperture. Let me drop. And by definition, whenever you've got a uniform aperture distribution, equal amount of power across each square inch of that circle, so to speak, that 5.5 foot, 6 foot diameter circle on 432, by definition, the guys doing study of the much higher frequency Yagi-like structures, you and I call it parabolic dish, and we're talking about optical telescope, and we're talking about diffraction-limited optical telescope, parabolic dish, where you get a 20th of a wavelength accuracy. By definition, you're getting Huygens' principle, and what is it now? You're getting the airy disk phenomenon. The first side lobe will be 17.5 dB down. The second side lobe will be 22 dB down. The third side lobe will be 28 dB down when you get diffraction-limited maximum performance. The optical people have discovered that a long time ago. They don't use the same words we do. They call it the airy disk multiple rings. We call them side lobes. A well-tuned Yagi has that exact performance. You and I know that there was a guy that is now a silent key who spent the last half of his life, let me drop. He spent the last half of his life using the best modeling programs, looking for that magic performance of Yagi-like antennas where all the side lobes would disappear. You can't do that. Good common sense would lead you to believe that all the energy in your side lobes is wasted energy. Absolutely not. It looks like wasted energy. You can make the aperture distribution across your parabolic dish, instead of being uniform where you get maximum gain, you can taper the energy near the edge so you don't get this abrupt discontinuity out of the perimeter of the parabolic dish. You can do that if you want. And yes, the side lobes will get weaker when you do that, but the gain falls off in the process. You can't get maximum gain and zero side lobes at the same time. It's a conflict of interest once you understand the laws of physics, if you know what I mean. So this man who, I can't remember his call letters now, I think he lived in Kentucky, he was taking the world's best modeling programs and looking for the magic Yagi design where all the side lobes would disappear because he thought that would be maximum gain. Absolutely not. As I said, every high-performance optical telescope where you've got hundreds of thousands of wavelengths of diameter of that parabolic surface, it will have the airy disk phenomenon. In other words, when you take a picture of one single star with a telescope, you're going to see a bright spot in the center, and you're going to see a whole bunch of dimmer and dimmer rings around it. Those rings do not represent an error in your optical telescope. They represent the laws of physics of aperture distribution, if you know what I mean. And a well-tuned Yagi has to follow those exact same laws. When have you ever heard it described this way? One of my articles that's on Mike Number Two's website uses these exact words. N2MB for any other comments. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, what I want to do, because I have a very thick head, I want to hear this lecture again because it was very good. And when will this appear in theaters near me? Take about 2 days or what?
Lately, Mike number one, which we know as Mike Perry, KC2NJI, he takes all of the information on the TechNet and displays it on the website called amateurradio.tangovictor. And most of the time, within about 3 days, it's there. So this is Sunday. A rough guess by Wednesday, this will be here. This will be on that website, and you can play it back as many times as you want, Barry. So therefore, all those beautiful telephone interruptions you had where you didn't hear all these words, where all these magic words were flying by you and you weren't capturing them because you were on the twisted pair, you'll be able to hear them at that time, Barry. N2MB, K2LAW.
Okay, amateurradio.microvictor, is that what you said?
Negatory. This website has been there for 7 solid years, Barry. The last 7 years of TechNets are all recorded at they're all recorded at www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tv. Is that a QSL, Barry? Go ahead.
Yeah, considering I spent half my life in the TV repair business, those numbers should have stuck in my head. Anyway, thank you. I will look at that in about 3 days, and I won't burden you. Thanks a lot, Dick. That's great. N2MB.
Now, hearing somebody on the input that was making a comment, what was that?
I said there's a link from my website there too, Dick, from Lima TechNet website. There's a link to to Mike Number One's website.
Okay, so there's multiple ways you can get there. And as this beautiful website that was brought to my attention this week by Dick Collins, K2UPS Mobile, he found this beautiful set of articles by Sugar Mike Zero, Victor Popper Oscar, SM0 VPO, Harry Lindfall, I think is his name, this man from Sweden, has this beautiful antenna. It's easy to build. It's 4 foot square on 80 meters. High performance antenna, 4 foot square with multiple wires as a spiral. And at first you would say, how in the world could a 4-inch square antenna give you the same performance as a 132-foot long wire dipole on 80 meters? Let me drop. He's not violating any laws of physics when he does that. It's a compact antenna, not too different in some of the characteristics of a so-called isotron, which used to be popular 20 or so years ago. I don't know if they still exist. But if you use the right materials that have no resistive loss, you can take an antenna that's 132 feet long and squeeze it down to a 4 foot square built on a spider-like structure of a PVC tubing, an X of PVC tubing that creates a 4 foot square, and with 5 turns of wire in there, which you resonate. That's the magic of resonance. And so at first you'd say, how in the world can you get full performance? Well, you get full performance as far as gain and pattern is concerned, and efficiency. Bad news, the antenna is, instead of a Q of 10, it's got a Q of 150. The antenna is 2. All right. So that every time you QSY by 32 kilohertz, you're going to retune the variable capacitor that's across the end of that coil that resonates it. As long as you're willing to live with that, then that antenna will cover all of 80 meters. If you have a 40 meter version of a 160 meter version, it'll cover all of that band. The magic of resonance. You've heard me say those magic 7 words so often. As long as you resonate, you can radiate. Once you radiate, you now can radiate. Well, once you resonate, now you can radiate. Those very 7 magic words. I haven't seen them printed in any good antenna article, in any good antenna textbook, or haven't heard anybody say those words in any good course on antenna engineering. Another one of the world's best kept secrets. The magic of an antenna is it must radiate. With rare exception. There is a very small number of antennas that are untuned. There's a so-called rhombic and beverage antenna, a so-called traveling wave antenna. Instead of it resonating, you put a zillion wavelengths into the thing. The antenna is going to be 6 wavelengths long if you want high performance. It's going to take up a whole lot of real estate. Let me drop it. As long as you're willing to invest in a whole lot of real estate, then now maybe you don't have to resonate the antenna. But any reasonable finite-sized antenna, and most of the antennas we build, are in the vicinity of a half wavelength physical size for the resonating elements, unless you start squeezing them down with various techniques. As such, it will be a standing wave structure. The antenna manufacturers or the antenna books will call it a standing wave structure, but they don't really describe what they mean by that. It really means the signal is going to bounce back and forth inside that antenna 10 or 15 times before it finally gets radiated. That's what is resonance, the signal bouncing back and forth. Every resonator you've ever built, the signal is bouncing back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor. In the case of a resonating antenna, the signal, the energy you put into that antenna is bouncing back and forth, and something like 5% of it radiates on each individual bounce. And it's going to be about 20 bounces before that energy is finally radiated that you're putting into it. That is the magic of the operation of a dipole. And none of the books that I can read describe that very basic phenomenon. In the process of it bouncing back and forth with a Q of 10 or 20, one of the definitions of Q is voltage rise at resonance. Another definition is current rise at resonance. Another definition is center frequency divided by bandwidth. Another definition is rise time versus fall to orbital full time. Another definition is energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. It sounds like 5 different definitions of Q. They are all the exact same definition. Let me drop. They're the exact same definition, just 5 different ways of looking at it, or 5 different ways of measuring it. But let's take one of those 5. Current rise at resonance. Because your antenna has got a Q of 10, 15, 20, your dipole-like antenna, I mean, somewhere in the middle of that dipole, the current is 10 or 20 times higher than the current that's coming out of your transmitter. That current magnification is making a huge magnification of the local magnetic field. That's what kicks the signal in the pants, and that's what finally starts the radiation process, the extra magnetic field. You take apart any of the computer modeling programs that's going to predict the performance, bandwidth, gain, pattern, and whatever of your antenna. You take any of the computer modeling programs. What really is going on inside? It takes your radiating element of your antenna. The program breaks it up by finite elements into a whole bunch of little bitty sausages, we could say. And by an iterative or by a recursive process, it eventually calculates what is the amount of current flowing into each one of those little bitty chunks. And now, because it knows the current flowing through that little bitty chunk, it knows the amount of magnetic field of that little bitty chunk. And at a point in space, it now adds up the effect of all of those magnetic fields in a vector manner, amplitude and phase, because that particular point in space has a particular amount of spacing to each one of those points. By the laws of geometry, there's a certain extra path length, so to speak, a varying path length, which changes the phase. And now you choose a whole bunch of points in space and add up all of those individual current magnitudes, which are really magnetic fields, and that is the antenna pattern. You can tell by the way the computer modeling programs work. The magic is the extra magnetic field. The extra magnetic field is coming from current magnification, which is coming from resonance. Now you know why.
Repeater, timeout.
Now you know why I say those magic 7 words. You resonate first, then you can radiate. Or you resonate first, and it will radiate. Put it any way you want. The 7 magic words are the world's best-kept secret. Anybody who's designing an antenna and doing an impedance match, and he wants the antenna to work well, whether he knows it or not, he's using those 7 words. He may not know it. Maybe his experience told him, I do this, this, and this, and it works. He's really resonating it. And now, you as an antenna designer have been given a task by your a handheld product, and here's the transmitter, and a couple pieces left over. We want you to design an antenna in that space that's left over. by whatever means, you're going to put a unshielded resonator in that space that you're going to call antenna. And you're going to resonate it and impedance match it to that transmitter that they've already put on that package. Because what happens, on very short-sighted manufacturers of handheld radio devices, like, say, for instance, cell phones, let me drop. They don't quite yet realize that the transmitter and the receiver can be gold-plated in that cell site, cell phone. And without an antenna that's working well, you've got nothing. And so they think their real problem is designing the transmitter and the receiver and the software and the display, and they put all kinds of people in concentration on that. At the end of the project, there's a couple of inches left over, and they say, I want to put an antenna in there. They really got it backwards. They should do it the other way around. The antenna is the most important part, because if it doesn't work well, they got nothing. As such, because the amount of space left over for the antenna, 90-some-odd% of the time, is so darn small, the only way you can put an antenna in there is that it's shrunk down electronically. It's very similar to this 35 kilohertz antenna that I'm talking about of SM0VPO. And therefore, almost every single cell phone that you buy and use today, you study what's inside, there is an antenna tuner in there. Because the antenna doesn't have the instantaneous bandwidth they want across all of those bands. They've now all bought this chip from, I can't even think of the name of the company that makes it. There's two or three companies making it. It is an impedance matching chip. It's an antenna tuner. So every time your cell phone hops from frequency A to frequency B, it goes to its lookup program, and it gives the right command to that antenna tuner that's inside in order to force that antenna into resonance so that it will radiate, so that it will transmit and receive. Ain't that crazy? We amateurs have been there a long time now. We're all starting to use antenna tuners. A hell of a lot of the rigs that we buy, let me drop. A hell of a lot of the rigs that we buy have a built-in antenna tuner to solve that problem of resonating your particular antenna. And as long as your antenna tuner has a large enough dynamic range to it, in theory, you can take any old hunk of wire as a end-fed zip, so to speak, and make it work. Resonance is the magic. None of the books say that. None of the courses say that. None of the professors say that. Not very many of the people say that, except for the hams that have slowly caught on to what's really happening. Anybody further comments or questions on what you've just heard on my little tirade, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And 2XGN, you want to go to filters?
Stand by a minute, West. Let's see if anybody has any further questions on the subject of antennas and how to make them radiate, how to make them radiate well, how to make them efficient. Anybody got any further questions on that? Give me your call letters right now. Okay, you guys all understand that. You're ready for the pop quiz I'll be giving you next Sunday. That's a joke. Okay, let's discuss filters. And one of the things that's kind of magic, very similar to antennas. You and I put energy into that antenna. We want it to be radiated into space. You put energy into a filter. Across the so-called passband, you want the energy to flow through the filter and come out impedance matched across that frequency region. And almost every filter that we built, that so-called band pass filter, there's a frequency region where the filter passes the signal, that's desirable. There's a well-defined frequency region where the antenna, where the filter will not pass the signal. And the first question you'll ask yourself, if you understand physics and the laws of conservation of energy, is what the heck happens to the energy that didn't get passed through the filter, the so-called stop band energy? Let me drop. And with rare exception, all the filters that we build, 98% of them, take the energy of the stop band frequency and reflect it back toward the signal generator. That's a fancy way of saying the filter has extremely high standing wave ratio at the stop band frequencies. That's how it does it. It reflects the energy back to the source. As such, you can tune up your filter by having a frequency sweeper put signals into the filter, and you can use some kind of a fast display device, like a crystal detector into an oscilloscope, to look at the amount of signal that passes through the filter at those various frequencies, and you can display that as a curve on the screen. You can tune a filter that way, the direct approach, the common sense approach. And when you're trying to tune the filter in the passband, where if it's a very high performance filter, and maybe the insertion loss of the filter in the passband is 1 or 2 tenths of a dB, and the reflection region of the filter, where it's reflecting signal, is reflecting signal such that the passband is rejected by 60, 80, 90 dB, look at the problem you've got in the dynamic range. You want to be able to display the stop band regions of the filter, 60 or 80 dB down. At the same time, you're trying to display the passband region with only 1 or 2 tenths of a dB. No reasonable display with reasonable dynamic range on that screen can do that. Even with logarithmic display, you can't do that. Let me drop. Therefore, you either set the screen up with high dynamic range so that you're looking at the rejection regions and you make the skirts of the filter look right, and you pray that the passband is low in insertion loss and has low ripple. Then you change the dynamic range of the display so you can look at, with expanded region of 1 dB per centimeter, you look at the passband region up at the top of the screen, and everything else is off at the bottom. And now you can look at the passband region, and you'll see all kinds of funny ripples that shouldn't be there because you haven't got the tuning just right. And now you retune the passband region to make it look flat, and you go back and look at the high display, the high dynamic range display, and you realize the skirts of the filter have now degraded. You can't look at both simultaneously, so to speak. And so you're between a rock and a hard place when you're trying to tune the filter as best it can. I'm talking about a 4, 5, 6 pole filter or beyond. And by the way, I've worked on filters that had 30 poles. And there is no computer modeling program that can tell you how to tune a 30-pole filter. The highest they went in those days was about 18 or 20 poles. So you can't even do a computer program prediction as to how to tune that filter. But there is a way. Let me drop. Once you realize that the only way the filter can have a passband and a stopband is by passing some signals and rejecting some signals. Now you do the inverse tuning of the filter. You put a real good vector network analyzer on the input of the filter, where the output of the filter has a good 50 ohm termination, and now you tune for the reflection coefficient. In the passband, if the reflection coefficient is 30 dB down, you know that only 1/1000th of the power going into that filter didn't get through the filter. So looking for 30 dB of rejection coefficient in the passband region, when you're looking at the reflection at the input of the filter, gives you a beautiful display. And in the regions where the filter is now rejecting the signal, the reject regions, you're going to get a reflection coefficient that's a small fraction of 1 dB. So when you do the inverse tuning of the filter, you get a much faster tuning procedure with much higher dynamic range, and you know what you're doing. It's a very simple tuning process when you do the opposite of common sense. You tune for the reflection of the filter, not the passband, even though your whole reason for using the filter in the first place is to have a defined region of frequency passband. Ain't that crazy? But that's the real world of high-performance filters and the right way to tune them. Been there, done that, and when I finally saw that procedure, I said, wow, why didn't somebody tell me that sooner? In 2XJN. Who's fiddling with filters. How many pole filter are you fiddling with, Wes? And what are you trying to pass and what are you trying to reject? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Nick, you are amazing. Absolutely. Top gun. No, I didn't mean to compliment you. LC filters, cavity filters, helical filters. That would be good to discuss. But since you have made a beautiful lecture at the beginning of it, you could take a look at the January 14 email. You're going to find something that you're probably going to love. It is not only the picture of extremely good German engineering, which is kind of weird, there are 4 or 5 pictures of the filters, and the most of the people wouldn't even say, what is it? Let me drop. But apart from that, there is a picture on the January 14 email that I have sent you. It shows the bandpass filter and the there is a link, and if you click on the link right below the first picture, you're gonna get to something that is absolutely beautiful. And that would be Wayne Wright Instruments GmbH. The history of the company was that there was a guy who was extremely skilled with it in 79. And now, after he died in 76, his family is going further and keeping the tradition. You have a program that allows you to do anything possible you would imagine with the filters. That means that when you link, click that link, you're gonna see as a graph that would be a graph telling you, say, you want to have a tunable band reject filter. And then it shows you a graph of that filter, but at the same time, at any possible place you wish, it gives you the empty box. Now, you can put the low frequency of your choice, high frequency of your choice. You could put the width of the filter at the bottom of it, and the ripple and of your choice, and it's gonna give you a complete calculation of whatever you want to. The reason that I brought it to your attention is because of extremely weird looking filters that those are on these pictures. So again, for you, it's January 14. And the title is Dig How It Works, Tunable Band Reject Filter. Okay. Now that company is giving you low pass filter, high pass filter, band pass filter, band reject filter, notch filter, tunable band pass filter, tunable band reject filter, tunable notch, duplexer LPHP, duplexer BPBP, duplexer BPBR, and those are only the standards. But you could go also to the custom filters, and then you have a plenty of others. So, not only the company is doing that, the filters are actually, we would say, act similar to an antenna. Whoop, you're gonna protest. But they also work with the cavity filters and helical filters. So since you know everything about that, maybe I can add something. Filters constructed with the resonators with conducting enclosures. So that would be those cavity filters, achieve the stepper slopes, and very much narrower stop bands, and higher selectivity. Downsides of it would be that the design is limited to spurious resonances of VSWR consideration of one. Helical filters, that's a real beauty of it, I love them. Construction with helical resonators, those types of design gives you a frequency, lower frequency filters to build in the smaller housings. I have a collection of whatever. It's a nice subject. I wonder if you found that email, N2XGF.
Yeah, I'm fairly far behind reading my emails. Wes, sorry to say, I've been fairly busy doing something else for the last couple of weeks, which I may explain to you if you and I have an eyeball. I've been saying to you guys for some time that there are probably 5,000 kinds of antennas. The vast majority of them resonate before they can radiate because they are standing wave structures. Every filter contains some number of resonators. I haven't done a thorough study, but I'll bet you there could easily be close to 5,000 kinds of filters. The two really good books on filters are Matai, Young and Jones and Zarev. Zarev is a Russian author of a very good filter book, and the Matai, Young and Jones book, which has been around for 20 or 30 years, is a real classic. I'm guessing it's got 1,200 pages to it. It's a big fat book. It's a little bit like the latest issue of the fifth edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. 1,200 pages, and you'll see lots and lots of filters. Let me drop. Many of the things that are called antenna, you would never recognize. You would never believe it's an antenna. By the same token, many of the kinds of resonators and the kinds of filters, there's lots and lots of kinds, and some of them you wouldn't even recognize. Every chunk of sheet metal on your automobile, where you create a slot below the paint and fill it over with fiberglass, can be built into an antenna and you would never see it. There are law enforcement vehicles where the side view mirror and the speaker on the rear deck is an antenna, and the fender is an antenna, and so on. And the bumper can be made into an antenna. By the same token, you can make filters out of all kinds of crazy things. And the filter can be built into the antenna. The antenna can be built into the filter. The filter can be built into the sheet metal of the airplane. There's ways you can make slots in the leading edge of the airplane, and it's a filter. The so-called frequency control surfaces. Are they called frequency control surfaces? I think so, yes. There's a whole class of pieces of sheet metal with step and repeat holes and X shapes and cross shapes, triangular shapes and whatever, by which you can synthesize a frequency selective surface. That's the word I'm looking for. You can make a piece of sheet metal act as a spatial filter. You can put the sheet metal as a radome over your antenna, and it is a filter. It'll pass certain frequencies and reject all the others. It'll pass certain frequencies at certain angles of arrival. It'll pass certain frequencies at certain polarizations. And that frequency selective surface can be a polarizer or a depolarizer. The frequency selective surface can take a circular polarized wave coming from free space and convert it into a linear wave that flows through that metallic surface and goes into your antenna, and vice versa. So the word filter in the modern day vocabulary is very different than it used to be, let me pick a number, 30 years ago. Let me drop. 30 years ago, frequency selective surfaces were being invented in order to create stealthy airplanes, in order to make them disappear from a radar screen. And so frequency selective surface used to be a classified word, just like the word radar in the mid-40s was a classified word. And so the word filter, as you can tell when you start looking at three-dimensional structures, and by the way, the layer of sheet metal that has these fancy holes and slots and triangles and everything else cut into it, that is a frequency selective surface that passes certain frequencies and rejects others. It doesn't have to be one layer. It can be multiple layers. Just like you have multiple poles in a filter, you can have multiple layers. And when you build that frequency selective surface of multiple layers just right, it can become a metamaterial. You can build material that acts like it's got a dielectric constant that Mother Nature never created. You can create negative impedance materials, negative dielectric constant materials, where the laws of index of refraction of the material behave backwards, if you know what I mean. Instead of a slow wave structure, it can be a fast wave structure. For instance, just like a piece of waveguide, the phase velocity on a piece of waveguide is faster than the speed of light. You're not violating any laws of physics, but as a tuning element, modern-day engineer who understands these concepts, and I didn't claim I'm an expert in this, there's a very good book, I wish I could think of the author's name right now, called Frequency Selective Surfaces. And you get that book and you start looking at those diagrams and reading the articles, and you'll see there's a whole class of filters you never believed would have existed. Let me drop. In the beginning, a filter was a circuit made out of inductors and capacitors with a particular topography and a particular interconnection, and sometimes you put some resistors in there if you're building a fancy filter that you want it to have absorptive characteristics as opposed to reflection characteristics. There is a so-called technique of building a filter, which is a so-called constant impedance filter. Very rare, but it exists. So in the past, filters were an array of inductors and capacitors and sometimes resistors. And sometimes the inductors were coupled together like a transformer, sometimes they're not. Sometimes the capacitors were...
Just that stupid bowl must be old.
Sometimes the capacitors were distributed structures. But now, with modern-day frequency-selective surfaces, you can build filters that you wouldn't even recognize in the old day. Let me drop. So, if I did a thorough enough study, Wes, just like I'm saying, I think there are 5,000 kinds of antennas. There might very well be 5,000 kinds of filters. So the word filter is a very broadband field, and if the front end of your receiver doesn't have a good bandpass filter, you are vulnerable as all hell. If you're designing a filter for your 2-meter receiver, where you want to pass 144 to 148 megahertz inclusive and reject everything else, to build that kind of a filter in the front end of your 2-meter receiver is a very intelligent thing to do. And therefore, the taxi cab that's radiating a kilowatt a block away at 155 megacycles hopefully gets rejected. That filter characteristic is so important that whenever anybody tells me that the day will come when you put a analog to digital converter right on the antenna, I become very skeptical. Because in order to have enough dynamic range to take the weakest or the strongest signal on 144 to 148 megacycles, in my example, and pass that through your analog to digital converter with enough resolution, enough bits, and enough timing fast enough to capture what's really going on. Let me drop. And if you didn't have a filter in the front end, and that taxi cab dispatcher at 155 megacycles radiating hundreds of watts a block away, he's going to bomb the living daylights out of your analog to digital converter in the front end if there isn't a damn good filter there. So, to build a modern-day receiver without a lot of filtering in the RF front end, in the IF strip, and so on, and even in the audio filtering to pass only the audio frequencies, and the sideband filter, and the notch filter to get rid of the heterodynes, and so on, you need all kinds of filtering. And yes, you can talk about ways of doing that in digital logic. I don't believe it. I don't think it's a practical approach yet. And maybe it's going to take decades before it is a practical approach to build a receiver that consists of nothing but an analog to digital converter connected to the antenna. It's a beautiful sounding concept, but if you've got enough dynamic range of that A to D converter that it can tolerate that taxi cab rig running 75 watts a block away and still pick up that quarter of a microvolt signal that you want to listen to on 2 meters, to have enough dynamic range to do all that without wraparound, the thing is going to be converting so fast and have so many bits that you're going to need let me drop. You're going to need liquid light nitrogen poured into that computer, because the computer is going to be processing 62 bits per second, if you know what I mean, 62 bits every microsecond, in order to keep track of what's all going on there. You better have a liquid nitrogen cooled computer, because the thing is going to be a screamer. And now you're paying a fortune for the computer that handles all those digital bits, as opposed to putting in a filter. With modern day concept, one way makes a lot of sense. The other way, not for a long time, do I think that's going to happen. So filtering, as you can tell, is extremely important. The good news is that an antenna only works well when it resonates. Because the antenna only resonates at certain frequencies, it automatically usually is a filter. There's a couple of exceptions to that. A well-built, very long rhombic antenna or beverage antenna could, in theory, work DC to light. It's an extremely broadband antenna. But that's an unusual antenna that uses a lot of real estate. Multiple wavelengths. It's going to, in the average HF antenna on beverage or rhombic, it's going to take up acres of property to work well. These are some of my top-of-the-head comments on the subject of filters. There's a lot of kinds of filter. And if you want to relate a filter to an antenna and you think I'm going to object to that, no way, Wes, you're right on. N2XJN, K2LIW.
N2XJN. If you have a time to find that January 14 email, or just write in your Google WAINWRIGHT, you're going to love it. Wainwright Instruments GmbH. I'm going to go to the program. I was especially interested with the duplexer, which actually gave you the two curves. You're going to go to it, so you're going to see it. But talking about the cavity filters, that's interesting stuff because cavity filters are available for 6 meters, 2 meters, 70 centimeters, and 23 centimeters as we speak. There is a company, KMK UK Limited. And I believe I have seen that on one of the hunters. It looks like you have a number of tanks. You have a small tank, say 10 inches in diameter and about 2 feet long. And all of those tanks are connected, and all they have is just the center screw of the nut. That's your tuning. And at the end of it, you have two end connectors. So one goes to the first tank and the other one goes to the last tank, where all of the tanks are connected with sort of the rigid coaxial cable, which is like a pipe. And it's a beauty. For those who are interested, they can check by filter number DPRE4 and then dash 4LB dash 6M, which stands for 6 meters. Again, the KMK UK Limited does it. Beautiful picture they have on the website, so one could go to it. See, the email that I have sent you is giving you a sort of the square rectangular box that is 2 inches high and approximately 20 by 20 inches. And the way that it is constructed is that you see a number of nuts and the screws. So in other words, is you have a nut just to stop the screw to fall down or go up by itself because of the vibration. So it's like just tightening that, but you have a special structure. So inside we can say we have a filter that is sort of empty. And let's say you have that box. Some of the boxes are like only inch tall, but then 20 by 20 inches. And then you have a one end connector and with two, end connectors from the output, or one end connector from the output and one from the input. And then you have a special structure, a number of screws that when you put them deeper or you put them a little bit more shallow, it gives you a ability to tune that special that space according to the given parameters of your choice. But not only there are some screws that are in diameter of say half of an inch, but there are certain screws that are in diameter of only 1/4 inch or 1/8 inch, and those are in between those. So say you have a set of the bigger screws and some set of the smaller screws, and then this company gives you the graph what is need for you to be done in order to retune what you chose to have based on the program that you fill up and send them the information. So absolutely amazing. It's like a custom filters for whatever you can have a notch filter if you want that, and just a few minutes later you have a specific cavity filter tuned to the particular band rejection or band pass. Absolutely magnificent. And to achieve it.
Yeah, you're describing now duplexing filters, and arguably one of the most exotic kind of filter is the duplexing filter that's on almost every repeater, like the one you're listening to right now. except for the split site repeaters. If all of the transmitting and receiving comes from one site, almost always there is a duplexing filter. And that filter is doing a yeoman job. It's one of the really high performance filters where your transmitter and receiver, in the case of 2 meters, are separated by 600 kilohertz. And across that 600 kilohertz region, it'll take a 70 watt output transmitter and couple 90 some odd percent of that energy to the antenna. And the receiving 600 kcoa from the same antenna goes through another filter with 1.5 dB of insertion loss and goes into the receiver. And because the receiver and transmitter are simultaneously connected to the exact same repeater antenna, let me drop. If you want maximum performance out of your repeater, you'll be using 6 cavities in that filter, 3 cavities, these tubular bandpass reentrant cavities tuned to the transmitting frequency, 3 more cavities tuned to the receive frequency. They all come together with a T connector that goes into the one antenna, and the transmitter and receiver gets connected to those sets of cavities respectively. And when that thing is tuned just right, there's 1.5 dB of insertion loss on the transmit frequency, 1.5 dB of insertion loss on the receive frequency, but the transmitter power that gets coupled into the receiver is rejected by roughly 130 decibels. That power ratio is 1 with 13 zeros after it. And if you're smart enough to do a good tuning job of that duplexing filter in that working environment, you'll get maximum performance out of that repeater with minimum intermodulation distortion and funny birdies. You pass just the signal you're interested in and reject everything else, including your own transmitter, which might be a foot away from that receiver. That duplexing filter, boy, it's got to work hard. Let me drop it. So each one of those cavity filters, built correctly, has a Q of something like 5,000. Very high performance filter. Quite often it's a tubular device on 2 meters, about 4 inches in diameter, and maybe it's about a foot or foot and a half long, and is a